Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host, and I'd like to ask you, what do you know about your mental multidimensionality? How multidimensional are you? Maybe you are just unaware of living as a multidimensional being, but you can't help it. And we're going to understand that better because we're talking to a man who we've had on the show many times before. We haven't. We've had him on the show once before, but we're going to have him on the show many times again.
That's for sure.
Because he's so terrific. And he really delves in this area of our, let's call it super beingness. And so let's get started talking with Dr. Melvin Morse. Melvin, thanks so much for being back on Energy Stew.
I'm excited. This is, I love being on your show because you explore topics that are so cutting edge and yet you bring it down to earth. You know, it is so the far out becomes prosaic.
I want to be logical about it all.
Yeah.
Not as much purely scientific, because if I was a traditional scientist, I would be a total naysayer. Because you can't,
I'm not sure.
Well, you can only.
I'm going to dispute that today, because I am a traditional scientist.
Right, you are. I'm talking about a different kind of traditional scientist.
That's
the
true.
Kind that don't want.
Because we're at the edge of a paradigm shift. And so anytime that you have these, you know, there's been, six, seven in Western civilization paradigm shifts in the past, thousands of years. And we're at a paradigm shift now in which we've gone from the materialistic scientific point of view, which says that, we're composed of atoms, which then create molecules, which then created cells, which then create organisms, which have brains, and then that brain creates consciousness. That paradigm is the old paradigm. Really, in the last 20, 30 years, the new paradigm is that consciousness comes first. And so that, it's interesting, this new paradigm does not dispute the old paradigm. It simply says consciousness comes first, then consciousness generates what's called information theory. And information theory is the basis of cell phone technology, almost all of cutting edge systems theory, which is important in engineering sciences, et cetera. So you have information theory, then you have the laws of physics, and then those laws of physics determine atoms and molecules and cellular structure and being.
But they exist already in these concepts.
Exactly. So we were talking about a book, An End to Upside Down Thinking, and by Guber, and I think that that's just the first of many such books that's going to come along to explain the scientific revolution.
Well, also,
but there's no question. Well, we are multidimensional beings.
Right.
We know that from theoretical physics, we know it from neuroscience.
And I recently recorded a show that's going to air this week with Christian DeQuincy, who is a consciousness university professor.
Oh, wow. I've got to watch that myself. That'll be very interesting.
Yeah, he's great. And so, I'm so happy to find all these like-minded people as you are. But I wanted to come back to what you were saying about consciousness and then information theory. And I believe is that consciousness starts off with just being pure consciousness, pure awareness,
exactly.
Without thought, without information. It doesn't need information. Because we've gone, exactly. For instance, you and I and everybody else, we've gone through our whole lives being aware of each moment of our lives, it's the same being in awareness. I can go back, you know, anywhere in my life and see myself being aware of experiencing that moment in life. And there was also information. And so the energy around consciousness is what created the universe, because the universe is information. It's all it is.
Yes.
Information. To give our consciousness something to play with.
Well, and this dovetails with what modern science is currently learning, but it also dovetails what we learned 2,500 years ago from the Buddhist scholars, the Buddha himself, from Jewish sages that lived in Eastern Europe at that time. You know, that, for example, the Buddha described consciousness just as you did, that it's a luminous light that has no thought, but that all of consciousness is part of it. Now, so what do I mean by modern neuroscience? I don't think it's well understood that human beings have two streams of consciousness. And we know this amazingly enough from, I was part of this when I was a medical student. They do split brain studies in which for various reasons, let's say intractable seizures, they actually sever a person's brain into its two parts. And then suddenly, for the first time in their lives, that hidden consciousness comes to life. So we have a verbal consciousness, or I love the way you put it, you know, the thought, you know, that sort of internal narrator, the chattering monkey, as some call it, that's clearly from the left brain. And then we have this really non-thought, non-linear, unconscious. Well, it's unconscious to us, but it's a stream of consciousness that appears to be linked with this universal thoughtless consciousness.
And what's interesting,
and we're just learning,
is what's interesting is that science has found that the more you repress the brain activity, the more consciousness expands. So even, you know, hallucinogens actually reduce brain activity. Near-death experiences are no brain activity, but even people in their dying states and people who have been in comas, people, you know, who are demented, as they're about to die, all of a sudden they have expanded consciousness and they speak clearly and they have clear minds. And that's from reduced brain activity. So as they're dying, their brain
Right. So, you know, I was trained to think that when the brain dies, then obviously consciousness died. But you're absolutely right. You know, from my studies of near-death experiences, as well as, you know, dozens of others, that when the brain dies, consciousness expands. It actually becomes beyond the human body. And this dovetails nicely with recent research on what does meditation do? And we now know that meditation follows precisely what you've described, is that the first stage of meditation is an area called Brodmann's area, which is in the back of the head, which integrates all of your five senses, and that area of the brain has to decrease activity. So you actually have to have less brain activity that suppresses this Brodmann's area, which is the ego-based, you know, five senses view of the world. And only then do the other areas of the brain, which allow us to communicate with this universal consciousness, come to life.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So how do we go about getting there?
Well, I've got a challenging question for you, though. I've been thinking a lot about this. My first question for you, Peter, is should we go there? I mean, we clearly are multidimensional beings. I mean, theoretical physics tells us that there's 10 dimensions, perhaps. They argue themselves over how many dimensions there are, but clearly there's more than just the three. Right. You know, they all agree on that. Right. But we're here it's seemingly for a specific reason. You know, those that have had near-death experiences that have interacted with this universal consciousness at the point of you know, at the end of their lives, tell us that we're here for that specific reason to learn lessons of love. So maybe we're meant to stay in this three-dimensional, very restricted consciousness in order to learn our lessons.
Well, I think that's the purpose of life. And what the, because people suffer so much. And why do they suffer? And I always say, because in the suffering, you're seeking wholeness. You're seeking peace. You're seeking love through your suffering. And that brings you to more light. And that lights the universe. And so there, the purpose of life is to light the universe more through the hard road that we're, you know, it's like creating pearls in an oyster shell. And so we could say, okay, that's, but how much of it do we need?
Well, you know, so I just wanted to pose that question. I'll give you an analogy that I often think of is I used to work in the infant intensive care unit where we had the infants in these little incubators. And there'd always be one infant that didn't want to stay in its incubator. That every time the nurses opened the little portholes, you know, to feed them or, you know, change dressings or whatever, those infants would make a break for it and try to get out. And I wonder to myself, you know, are we being that foolish? You know, or are we like those infants? You know, we're meant to stay in this three-dimensional restricted universe. You know, because obviously if those infants did in fact escape, they would be endangering themselves and they wouldn't be able to develop properly.
But that's so, an important... that's very important.
Yeah, our suffering is for a reason.
Right, but let's look at the NDEs. Let's look at these, you know, thousands of people, millions of people likely, have had NDEs and have seen the light, have been in blissful environments and come back. Because otherwise it wouldn't be an NDE, it would be a DE. And
right.
So why do they choose to come back? And fortunately for them, they've had the experience of the other side. So when they come back, their memory usually is intact enough to tackle the struggle of this dimension with more clarity and optimism because they've seen the light. Because as we are born, there's a veil that we forget where we've come from. And we're in the suffering, and it just looks terrible, and we don't know what to do about it. But when you've seen the other side, and you come back, you have a higher aspect about it.
Well, I want to expand on that then, piggyback on that, because I do want to come back to that. Many people don't want to come back, but when people come back from their near-death experience, invariably, it's for love. They feel that there's something unfinished. One girl told me that she was to have a brother who was born with heart disease, so she had to help her mother. But one of the cases that taught me the most was this young man who told me that he had a near-death experience, nearly drowning. When he was about 10, and he told me that a voice told him, "Go back, Bobby, you have a job to do." So this was earlier in my, in my studies, and, you know, I was sort of full of myself and a little bit skeptical about all this. And I interviewed him as part of a study of the long-term, what happens to you over the long term of having a near-death experience. So I interviewed him when he was in his 20s. And so I was like, oh gosh, so he has a job to do, the cure for cancer or something like that. And he saw the look on my face and he said, "I already told you what my job is. I run a small construction company. And, those numbnuts wouldn't know what to do with me if they didn't have me to employ them."
Everybody has a path.
Right. He came back from his near-death experience to run a small construction company.
Yeah.
So that tells us something very important, you know, that we're meant to live the life that we live. And, you know, it's not, they don't come back for grandiose reasons. They come back for very simple, present reasons.
But I work with
the ordinary life we live.
I work with a lot of people who struggle and don't feel that they're living the life that they were supposed to live, that they're not on purpose, because they're working so hard with their struggles. And I look at them and I go, guess what? This is it. This is the life you've come here for. Maybe there's more to it after you're done with what you're doing now. But right now, just embrace that this is part of what you came for.
Right. That, you know, I have learned that the hard way. That virtually whatever it is that we're dealing with is what we're meant to deal with. Now, that's not to say that then that gives us some sort of free pass. That just gives us encouragement, you know, to know that we've got to struggle through at those times when it just feels overwhelming. When the stuff, you know, it is true. It's not true that God gives you only what you can handle. Some people get things that they can't handle. And I think that I personally have been able to share with them what I know about the near-death experience, which teaches us that we're here to learn lessons of love, to be able to then encourage them. And, you know, just as it sounds like you have in your work, where you have to say, no, wait a moment. This is your struggle. This is what you're here to learn.
Right. As limited as it might feel.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, that's, so that brings up another question then, is how do we know when the universe is talking to us? You know, how do we know when our multidimensional consciousness is in sync? You know, when do we know that a word of encouragement is coming to us versus something that's generated by our own ego, that's a response to fears or anxieties? You know, how can we sense that?
Well, I feel that everything is in divine order, even our egos. And the suffering that our egos create for us is all right.
Well, that's a really interesting way to look at it. That's a really interesting way to look at it. Because I've always tried to differentiate, you know, what thoughts are coming from my own ego, you know, and then what is actually a sign from the universe, if you will. But what you're saying is I don't need to make such a fine distinction between the two.
Right. And I've had many times in my life where my ego seemed to be running things, causing trouble. And I've had a lot of parts of my life that really were lousy because I wasn't thinking straight. It was like that ego was pushing me. And I look back on it all, and I'm grateful for all of it. You know,
interesting.
At this age, and there was, you know, so much pain, but it brought me to who I am and what I know. And, you know, I've gained so much wisdom from the journey that I was on. And I tell that to people all the time. You're on a wisdom journey. You know, you might be bumping along, hard bumps, but look at the wisdom it's created.
So, in other words, we shouldn't regret our mistakes, but we should embrace them and learn from them and see them as part. Because I'm always trying, well, I don't think it's just me. I think that many of us are looking to sort of a higher power to guide us. But what I'm understanding you to say is maybe a higher power is just to support us, to help us.
I love that.
But we do need to be more aware of our suffering.
Right.
And the suffering of right. I think that to understand the suffering of others is so important as a way of growing your character and, again, becoming part of a multidimensional being?
Well, I believe that we come into life, we're shown a basic understanding of the life we're coming into. And we know, okay, I'm going to be dealing with this and that. Oh, that's going to be terrible. But look where I am now. Where I'm coming from is this beautiful other higher dimensional universe that I'm going to come back to. So maybe I can deal with it. Maybe I'll get into this and learn the hard lessons that my soul will benefit from and the universe will benefit from. And I'll step into this life and have these terrible things happen. And it'll, that search, that purpose of trying to find light and love in every hardship will be so much stronger. And I think souls are so brave to come into this world and do this.
Well, it's in times of suffering that we find God. There's no right. question about that.
Right.
That, you know, when I look around, I think it's in the most difficult and extreme situations. And often it's we find God in the wrong places. We find God in the so-called refuge of society, you know, the criminals, the, you know, our so-called criminals, the impoverished, the people who are challenged in so many different ways. Interestingly enough, that's where I find God. In my interactions with those people.
Right. And maybe the strongest way to find God is to have a near-death experience. And that's about as harsh as it can be that you...
Well, you know, I think that through meditation, you can find the same types of understandings. You know, they're not as profound, you know, obviously, right. because right. near-death experience wipes away your ego completely. But the process of meditation, in which, as you say, turns off the ego-driven areas of the brain, can sometimes allow us to then enter into that luminous universe.
Yes, but it's temporary.
You know, right. And it's temporary. And it's something I think that takes practice. Right. You know, the oftentimes the people, you know, the when in meditation, they'll well, I can't meditate, I can't sit there for so long, or etc. There's many different ways to meditate. There's a movement oriented meditation. Really, meditation goes back to what you said originally, Peter, which is it's simply to be in the now. So oftentimes, meditation is just paying attention. You know, taking a walk in the woods,
sure.
but carefully.
Contemplation.
You know, I see, right.
Contemplation.
You know, I see green leaf. I see the pattern and textures of the bark. Those types of active meditation techniques, I think, work best for modern man anyway. You know, the traditional meditation was, of course, developed at a time where there weren't cell phones, there weren't the stresses that we have in our ordinary lives, there weren't the constant noise in the background, et cetera. So, you know, we need new meditation techniques for the 21st century.
Well, I interviewed a man who went up into the Himalayas and meditated in a cave for 3 months, and he would go into 15 hours of bliss at a time. But when he was done, he'd have to go out of the cave to go get food in the local village and deal with all the hardships of life in the Himalayas. And he realized that, wait a minute, you know, these 15 hours of bliss were beautiful. I loved it. But then here I am back in reality of crazy people doing crazy things.
That reminds me of a Jewish story in which a seeker, you know, seeks out a rabbi who is meditating, you know, in a cave in the wilderness. And the seeker says to him, you know, what is the meaning of life? And then the answer is, what? Why are you asking me? Go down to the marketplace. You know, go down to the woman who has to, you know, to struggle to survive and keep her family going. You know, that's where you should go to find the meaning of life. You know, I'm just simply here, you know,
meditating,
blowing my consciousness.
Right.
But I wanted to. I wanted
we
to.
We only have a minute or two left, by the way.
Oh, okay. Well, I got to tell you real quick then. The modern game Tetris, which is a video game, has been shown from scientific studies to be just as powerful as meditation.
Wow.
You know, the typical type of meditation that you're describing. Even going on to, for example, healing post-traumatic stress disorder and triggering a variety of different types of psychological healings from playing the video game Tetris. And this is published in the magazine Science.
That's so, wonderful. Yeah. Thank you. And so let's tell our audience where they can find out more information about you and your work.
Well, my website is Melvin Morse, M-D. So that's just MelvinMorseMD.com. And please, I love to talk to people. I'm still doing a lot of near-death research. I have a particular interest in remote viewing. So come to my website, drop me an email, and we can continue this dialogue or continue to listen to Peter's show.
Yeah, we're going to have more. This is so much fun to talk with you. And I'd love to explore these areas of understanding that you've been able to appreciate in your life. And so, Melvin, thanks so much for being at Energy Stew. It's such a pleasure.
Oh, it's so wonderful to be able to, you know, so often we live such, you know, constricted lives and we can't really explore all of this. And this is just a wonderful opportunity for me to have fun with these ideas, which otherwise from the scientific point of view, you know, have to be carefully documented and, you know, et cetera.
Right. And right. So we enjoyed the exploration. Right. So thank you so much.
And thank you so much.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org. I'd love to hear from you. And thanks so much for listening. Thank you.